You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 137, Spain on the Precipice. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. This project lives or dies on audience support. To those of you who have already chipped in, thank you for helping me keep it going. As for the rest of you, I'd ask you to spare a few moments to think about what this show has meant to you. If the answer is nothing, fair enough. But if you've been entertained, moved, or learned something, I hope you'll consider what that's worth to you, and think about what you're capable of contributing. Thank you. I should also mention that the patrons-only bonus episodes are still going strong. The last installment was actually one of my favorites. We talked about Josephine's ambiguous relationship with the institution of slavery, along with several other topics. If you're interested in joining, visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon. Anyway, last episode we were getting caught up on the war in Iberia in the latter half of 1809. A combined Anglo-Spanish army under Generals Gregorio de la Cuesta and Arthur Wellesley, now known by his new title, the Viscount Wellington, had won a convincing victory over the French at the Battle of Talavera in late July. But after Talavera, nothing seemed to go right for the Allies. Soon after the battle, the French regained their strategic footing and were able to outmaneuver the Allied forces, thwarting the push on Madrid, and dealing the Patriots a devastating defeat at the Battle of Almonacid. The Spanish experienced some limited success in other regions of the country, but the Supreme Junta decided to rush in to another offensive on Madrid. They poured almost all the country's remaining resources into a massive new force, the Army of La Mancha, which became the centerpiece of a new operation to retake the capital. Unfortunately for the Patriots, the Army of La Mancha's inexperienced commander, General Juan Carlos Arrézaga, led them into disaster. On November 19, 1809, more than half the army was destroyed at the Battle of Ocaña, swallowed up by a single massive cavalry charge, orchestrated by Marshal Jean de Dieu Soult. As you might recall, there had been two Spanish armies involved in this latest push on Madrid. Arrézaga and the Army of La Mancha making the main thrust from the south, and a secondary force, the so-called Army of the Left, advancing from the west. They were led by General Diego Vicente Cañas Portocarrero, better known by his noble title, the Duke del Parque. In the early phases of Napoleon's invasion, the Duke had actually been a supporter of the House of Bonaparte. He was an adherent of the Enlightenment and held liberal and progressive sympathies. He had hoped the French would bring Spain's antiquated government into the 19th century. But seeing the country reject Joseph Bonaparte and the draconian response from the French authorities had turned him in the opposite direction. Now he was a fervent patriot. In fact, he was so committed to the cause, he had even gone so far as to open fire on his own men when they tried to flee the field at the Battle of Tamames. It was a brutal order, almost unprecedented in Napoleonic warfare. That said, the Patriots had won the battle, making the Duke one of the few Spanish commanders who could claim to have beaten a major French force in a straight-up fight. The Duke maneuvered his army well in the opening phase of the campaign, edging closer to Madrid while avoiding larger imperial forces and using the terrain to protect his small army. He had a few veteran units, but many of his men were fresh recruits, picked up in areas recently liberated from French control. The Duke knew he had to be careful with these newly raised units. Their morale was high, but there had been little time to train before the campaign was launched. Some were not much better than armed civilians. And as we discussed last episode, by this phase of the war, almost every Patriot military formation was suffering from leadership problems due to the shortage of trained, experienced officers. Still, all things considered, the army performed well. The way it maneuvered over rough terrain, you never would have guessed this was the first campaign for so many of its soldiers. But the disaster at Ocaña undid all this limited progress. With the Army of La Mancha defeated, all French forces in central Spain were now free to concentrate on the Army of the Left. Obviously, the Duke del Parque had no choice but to retreat. He went west, back the way he came, hoping to put the Tormes River and the mountains of the Sierra de Gredos between the Army of the Left and the enemy. He was pursued by a French corps under General François-Étienne de Kellermann, son of the famous General François-Christophe de Kellermann from the War of the First Coalition. The Army of the Left made good progress, outrunning Kellermann's horsemen. A week after Ocaña, they arrived at their objective, the town of Alba de Tormes, on the banks of the Tormes River. Del Parque ordered his cavalry back into the army's rear to scout for any pursuing French units. They found none. Apparently, the Army of the Left was safe. They would rest at Alba de Tormes for a few days, then complete the crossing of the Tormes. The campaign had been a failure, but at least they would all live to fight another day. November 28th saw the Army of the Left spread out around the town, taking advantage of the mild weather and pleasant countryside. The men were sleeping, repairing their clothing and equipment, and preparing to cook what was probably their first proper hot meal in at least a week. This calm scene was suddenly interrupted by the sound of distant bugle calls, soon followed by thousands of hoofbeats. The Patriot scouts had failed the army badly. General Kellermann had arrived with all his cavalry, roughly 4,000 troopers, and had managed to get almost right on top of the Army of the Left without anyone noticing. Those bugle calls represented the beginning of a major French attack. The Spanish could not have been less prepared for a battle. Not only was the army resting, it was scattered across a huge area. Crucially, Del Parque's forces were roughly split in half by the river, with part of the army on the west bank and the other half on the east, connected only by a narrow stone bridge. The town of Alba de Tormes was on the east bank. Kellermann was attacking along the west bank, where there were just wide-open plains. There was nothing to slow the French horsemen and nowhere for the Patriot troops to hide. Amazingly, about 1,000 Spanish cavalrymen managed to gather their weapons and equipment, mount up, and launch a countercharge, but they were unprepared, outclassed, and outnumbered by about 4-1. Kellermann's troopers brushed them aside easily and advanced on the Patriot infantry. You might think the inexperienced, poorly led Spanish troops would have panicked in such desperate circumstances. But, by and large, they held their nerve. Against all odds, Patriot officers on the west bank managed to rally their troops and get them into formation. The western half of the Patriot army received the French charge in something resembling a line. However, as we've seen time and again in this theater of the war, the Spanish found it very difficult to stand against French regulars in a straight-up fight, particularly mounted troops on the charge. That flat terrain around the river was perfect cavalry country. Kellermann's vanguard built up an impressive head of steam as they closed in on the Spanish. The Patriots opened fire, but they couldn't stop the French from punching right through the center of the line. Patriot units in the center were shattered. Some men threw down their weapons and raised their hands in surrender. Others took off running for the bridge, hoping to find safety with the rest of the army. Hundreds were cut down by the French. There was a terrifying crush of bodies and wagons on the bridge. There were lots of non-combatants on the west bank, logistics men who were now busy trying to save the army's baggage train, the merchants and tradesmen who followed every Napoleonic-era army, and even some of the soldiers' wives and children. Masses of panicked soldiers mingled with the civilians, everyone fighting to cross, creating a deadly, intractable bottleneck. The Duc del Parque deployed the other half of the army along the east bank, so their firepower might deter the French from slaughtering all these people on the bridge, but there was little else he could do. Meanwhile, back on the west bank, most of the Patriot units on the left and right of their rough line were still in good order. The officers along the flanks worked desperately to form their men into squares, while the French horsemen rode down the panicked survivors of the center. Despite the chaos unfolding all around them, the Patriots managed to pull it off. Soon, two large squares had taken shape, containing most of the surviving Spanish troops west of the river. This development put General Kellermann in something of a dilemma. To preserve the element of surprise, he had attacked at the very first opportunity, before his infantry or artillery had arrived, with only his highly mobile mounted units. As we've discussed in past episodes, the three branches of a Napoleonic army, infantry, cavalry, and artillery, formed a complete system. Under a skilled commander, each branch compensated for the weaknesses of the others and augmented each other's strengths. The infantry square was a perfect example. Under the right conditions, squares were practically invulnerable to cavalry. However, they were vulnerable to firepower. With the men inside the square bunched closely together, musket fire and especially cannon fire could rip the formation apart very easily. Kellermann had no significant firepower at his disposal to break those squares. Some of his units were equipped with carbines, short, inaccurate muskets, but most only had pistols. His infantry and artillery were marching on the double to reach the battlefield, but were still hours away. Fortunately for the French, Kellermann had come up as a cavalry officer. Commanding mounted troops was his specialty, and he had a plan to keep the Spanish pinned down until the infantry and artillery arrived. He led his troopers in a complicated series of maneuvers around the Patriot squares, launching charges, then canceling them before they got within musket range, keeping the enemy in check but never risking his meager forces. Remember, we are talking about 4,000 cavalry troopers against an entire army. Even after the losses they had suffered early in the battle, the Patriots had at least four times as many troops on the field. However, with the French controlling that strip of open land along the river, the remaining Spanish forces on the west bank were unable to move towards the bridge and safety, and their comrades on the east bank were unable to move to reinforce them. And so, after the dramatic opening moves of the battle, things settled into an odd stalemate, with the French horsemen dancing around the Spanish squares, and the Patriots unable to make any significant maneuvers or strike at their enemy. It must have been maddening. This continued for hours. Finally, someone on the Patriot side noticed dust on the horizon. This could only mean one thing. Significant numbers of French infantry were approaching the battlefield, presumably accompanied by at least some artillery. Once these forces deployed, it was easy to see how the rest of the battle might turn out. The French would surround those embattled squares on the west bank, whose commanders would only have two choices: surrender or stand firm and allow their men to be slowly killed off by enemy firepower. About half the army of the left would be destroyed, and their comrades on the opposite bank wouldn't be able to do anything but watch. It would be a disaster almost on the scale of the Battle of Ocaña. But the Patriot officers on the west bank reacted quickly and decisively. Rather than waiting for certain destruction, they would take a big risk. All of a sudden, after hours of stalemate, the Spanish squares suddenly lurched into motion, marching for the bridge double quick. The French cavalry charged yet again, this time engaging with their opponents. The fighting was fierce, but most of the remaining Patriot troops on the west bank made it to the bridge, where they were able to cross safely under the covering fire of the other half of their army. By the time the French infantry arrived, the two halves of the Army of the Left were reunited and already retreating from their positions. As the sun set, there was skirmishing around the town of Alba de Tormes. The French came out on top, but these were rearguard actions. Most of the Patriot forces had already slipped away. On paper, the Battle of Alba de Tormes should have been a complete disaster for the Spanish, almost as bad as Ocaña. But Patriot leaders had responded surprisingly well to the crisis. Their inexperienced troops had shown more courage and toughness than anyone could have reasonably expected. But these good performances had merely turned a potential catastrophe into another defeat. The Army of the Left had lost somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 men, between a fifth and a quarter of its total strength. The French had also captured significant amounts of supplies and equipment. Kellermann's forces only suffered about 600 casualties. As is typical for this theater of the war, there are reports of abuse and even murders of captured Patriot soldiers in the wake of the French victory. There were rumors circulating among Kellermann's corps of similar massacres by the Spanish earlier in the campaign, which may have actually been true. It seems at least some of the French soldiers believed in taking an eye for an eye. For the Patriots, the consequences of this defeat would actually be worse than the battle itself. As the remains of the Army of the Left retreated into the night, some of its units began to disintegrate. We've seen this in several past episodes. The Patriot volunteers were highly motivated, but easily disillusioned. After major defeats, their armies sometimes suffered badly from desertion. That night, hundreds of men slipped away into the darkness. They would be followed by many more in the days to come, perhaps as many as 8,000 total, according to one source, which would represent more than half of what remained of the army. With Kellermann hot on his heels, the Duc del Parque had no choice but to lead his few thousand remaining soldiers into the mountains. With winter setting in, the French could not follow them into punishing alpine terrain. However, with few supplies and little to forage in this harsh, barren landscape, those few brave men who stayed with the army were facing a horrible winter. Many died of hunger, disease, or exposure. As the situation became more desperate, there were fresh rounds of desertions. The Army of the Left was dying. Within a few months, it had practically ceased to exist. Meanwhile, back in central Spain, the remains of the Army of La Mancha were dealing with the aftermath of their own devastating defeat at Ocaña. It took days for General Arésaga to rally his forces. Once the situation was finally under control, he wrote a letter to the Supreme Junta, officially reporting the disaster that had befallen the army, accepting responsibility, and offering his resignation. Amazingly, he was refused. The Army of La Mancha was now faced with an urgent task. The Supreme Junta did not want a change in leadership distracting from this all-important mission. As you may recall from past episodes, central and southern Spain are separated by a chain of mountains, the Sierra Morena. Southern Spain had been the heartland of the Patriot resistance, almost since the outbreak of the war. It had been the last part of the country to be penetrated by the French invaders, and the first to see them successfully expelled. The main ports of entry for British military aid were in the south. The Supreme Junta itself was in the south, headquartered in the city of Seville. Much of the country's remaining tax base was here, as were the most important recruiting grounds for the Patriot armies. Maintaining control over this region was of paramount importance if Spain hoped to recover from these staggering blows. However, it would be a very tall order. By now, King Joseph and Marshal Soult had roughly 70,000 men concentrated in the area. On top of the majority of its manpower, the Army of La Mancha had lost huge amounts of supplies and equipment, and almost all of its artillery. As you can probably infer from the huge number of deserters, morale was abysmally low. Still, at least the Spanish had the terrain on their side. To enter southern Spain, the French would have to seize at least one mountain pass. As we've seen in past episodes, units well positioned in mountain passes could hold off forces many times their size. Despite the terrible condition of the army, perhaps a brilliant commander could have used this advantage to pull off an upset victory. But as we've seen, Arrasaga was no brilliant commander. The way things worked out, the remains of the Army of La Mancha could not hold. Soult's forces chased them all the way through central Spain to the Sierra Morena, then forced their way over the passes with little resistance. The gateway to the Patriot heartland was now wide open. Having failed again, Arrasaga was finally relieved of command. He would remain in the Spanish military, and would even lead troops in battle again, but would never hold another independent command. However, for most of the rest of his career, Arrasaga was dogged by an ongoing official inquiry into his defeat at Ocaña, which wouldn't finally conclude until after the war was over. Unsurprisingly, his conduct as commander of the Army of La Mancha came under severe criticism. But Arrasaga escaped any official punishment. It has been speculated that his political connections shielded him from more serious consequences. The Supreme Junta had put almost all of Spain's available strength into the Army of La Mancha. There was little left to resist Soult as he pushed into the south. Spain no longer had any significant field armies. As we discussed earlier, the Army of the Left was in its death throes. What remained of the Army of La Mancha was not much bigger than a single division of the French military, and after the beating they had taken, they would need new weapons and equipment, and a significant period of rest and reorganization before they would be ready for any major operations. The Spanish did have smaller formations at their disposal, and there were units that had been left behind to garrison the rear, but these were mostly of poor quality, the second-line units of a second-rate military. The cream of the Patriot forces was simply gone, lying dead on the fields of Ocaña or Alba de Tormes, captured by the invaders, or vanished into the countryside, having lost their faith in the war effort. The Patriots did still have one remaining stronghold behind French lines. In fact, not too far from the Franco-Spanish border. The Catalan city of Girona had been placed under siege by a large French army early in the year, but was still bravely holding out. It was almost a repeat of the Siege of Saragossa, which ended only a few weeks before the French surrounded Girona. Like at Saragossa, Girona was built on the banks of a river. Its defenses were antiquated, but it was an old city, with lots of narrow streets and stone buildings, which favored the defenders. Just like at Saragossa, the people of the city had joined in the defense, even women and children. They even had a charismatic leader who had risen to national prominence due to the heroism of the defense. At Saragossa, it had been General José de Palafox. At Girona, it was Brigadier General Mariano Alvarez de Castro, a career officer in his late 50s who had mostly served in obscurity until the French invasion. Girona was a major priority for the French. There was an obvious strategic significance. Girona was far behind the front lines. Any major enemy stronghold so deep in the rear was a potential danger. It also commanded one of the main roads back to France, creating logistical problems the French could ill afford. But this was also a question of pride. Imperial forces had tried to take the city twice in the past, and been thwarted both times. Girona's continued resistance had become something of an embarrassment. They could not allow a third failure. The French approached the city in early May 1809, about 3 months before Talavera. They were led by General Jean-Antoine Verdier, who had experience in these types of operations. He had led the imperial forces at Saragossa during the first siege of that city, where he had been repeatedly frustrated, badly wounded, and eventually forced to retreat due to French setbacks elsewhere in the country. Verdier seems to have learned his lesson from that failure. At Girona, he adopted a slow, methodical approach. The previous sieges had been somewhat haphazard affairs, carried out by armies built for field operations, not siege warfare. The results spoke for themselves. This time, the French had come with lots of engineers and heavy artillery. Verdier would use these resources to systematically reduce the Spanish defenses. In past episodes, we've talked about the international character of the forces fighting in Iberia. Girona was a perfect example. Local Catalans were predominant among the defenders, but there were also soldiers and volunteers from elsewhere in Spain. On top of that, several of the foreign regiments of the pre-war Spanish army were stationed here, including Irishmen and Walloons, French speakers from modern Belgium. The majority of the imperial forces were non-French, including Swiss, Italian, and German detachments. There would have been engagements during this siege where the men fighting for Napoleon were speaking German and the men fighting for the Allies were speaking French. Girona was an almost unbelievable headache for the French. As we already discussed, the city commanded one of the main roads into Iberia from France, forcing a huge proportion of French supply convoys and reinforcements headed into this theater to detour around the siege lines. On top of that, Girona became a focal point for Spanish resistance, attracting guerrillas and even groups of Spanish regulars, hoping to harass the besiegers or even break the siege. French commanders were forced to deploy huge forces in this region, on top of the 15,000 or so soldiers required to maintain the siege lines. This one comparatively small city, with a garrison of under 10,000 soldiers, was tying down about a corps' worth of manpower. As we've seen in past episodes, there was a method to sieges in this era, the attackers slowly closing the noose, focusing first on outlying fortifications and neutralizing them one by one, working their way closer and closer to their objective. A siege was almost more of an engineering problem than a military one. With the proper resources and no outside intervention, besieging forces that adopted this scientific outlook were practically assured of victory, although a determined defense could make that inevitable victory almost unbelievably slow and costly. And the defenders of Girona were certainly determined. And they were bolstered by difficult terrain. The city is in the foothills of the Pyrenees. The Patriots held the high ground. They had built extensive fortifications around the city, and many of their positions were natural fortresses in their own right. The French made progress, but it was agonizingly slow. Months dragged on with no end in sight. General Verdier was superseded by more senior commanders. First, General Laurent de Gouvion-Saint-Cyr, a brilliant and long-serving officer whose Republican sympathies had hampered his career after the rise of Napoleon. When Gouvion-Saint-Cyr failed to produce results, he was replaced by a Marshal of France, our old friend Pierre Augereau, who has been a part of this story since the First Italian Campaign. By this point, another factor had come into play, disease. This was almost an inevitability in such protracted sieges. With so many people in close quarters, often malnourished and living in poor conditions, with inadequate medical resources, these were perfect breeding grounds for viruses and bacteria. By autumn, around the time the Supreme Junta was launching the doomed offensive we've been discussing in these past few episodes, the situation at Girona had become dire. Both the attackers and the defenders were being ravaged by multiple outbreaks, Thousands of soldiers on both sides were bedridden, and dozens were dying every day. It was a horrible situation for all involved. However, it definitely favored the French. They could bring in reinforcements. The Patriots could not. The Patriots also had to worry about the civilian population of the city, who were dying in droves right alongside the soldiers. Marshal Augereau paused offensive operations. His own forces were weak, and disease was doing their work for them within Girona. On December 12, 1809, General Alvarez surrendered the city. He had little choice. Half the garrison and around half the civilian population were dead. Many of the survivors were sick or malnourished and no longer in any condition to resist, including Alvarez himself. Marshal Augereau's men did not enter the city in triumph. The risk of infection was deemed too great. The French had finally conquered Girona, but the cost had been tremendous. In 7 months of punishing siege warfare, the imperial forces had suffered about 15,000 losses, mostly to disease. The Patriot military forces suffered around 5,000 casualties, and somewhere around 6,000 civilians had lost their lives. General Alvarez would soon join them. He was already sick when he surrendered to the French in mid-December. By late January, he was dead. Consensus among historians seems to be that his illness got the better of him, perhaps helped along by poor treatment at the hands of his captors. However, at the time, consensus among the Spanish patriots was that he had been poisoned by the French. Revenge for all the humiliations they had suffered before the walls of Girona. Mariano Alvarez joined the ever-growing pantheon of martyrs to the cause. After his death, the Spanish military granted Alvarez a posthumous promotion all the way to the rank of marshal. From a coldly rational perspective, the Third Siege of Girona had been a massive success for the Patriot cause. They had been a thorn in Napoleon's side for the better part of a year, tied down over 30,000 imperial troops, and inflicted 3 casualties on the enemy for every one they suffered themselves. The city's heroic resistance had become something of a legend, bolstering national morale, and proving once again that it was possible to defy the French under the right circumstances. But the surrender had come at a very bad time, right on the heels of the twin disasters at Ocaña and Alba de Tormes, just as Marshal Soult was pushing into Andalusia. The fall of Girona only added to the general atmosphere of desperation and doom among the Patriots. Everything seemed to be going wrong for the Spanish, even things that were totally outside their control. As you may remember from past episodes, the war between France and Austria ended in mid-July 1809. When the Habsburgs had begun rattling their sabers before the start of the war, Napoleon had been forced to leave Spain and bring many of his best troops with him to face off against this new threat in Central Europe. By late 1809, the war against Austria had been over for months. French units that had been tied down in the east were beginning to cross the Pyrenees to reinforce their comrades still fighting in Iberia. By early 1810, nearly 100,000 fresh imperial troops had arrived in Spain. Generally speaking, they were of good quality, especially compared to the second-line troops we often see in this theater. The only significant coalition force that remained to oppose them was the Viscount Wellington's small British army. By late September, they had completed their difficult retreat through western Spain and the Spanish-Portuguese border region, and arrived back in their comparatively safe and comfortable bases in western Portugal. But even here, they would find no rest. The army was struck by disease, probably exacerbated by poor nutrition on the march back from Spain. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, died. Wellington himself fell ill, although the case was apparently mild and he recovered fully. Although the British had won a convincing victory alongside their Spanish allies, the Talavera campaign had left Wellington deeply pessimistic about the future of the Spanish resistance. He was especially critical of the Supreme Junta. In a letter back to the government in London, Wellington wrote, quote, "They have attempted to govern the kingdom in a state of revolution by adherence to old rules and systems, and with the aid of what is called enthusiasm. And this last is in fact no aid to accomplish anything, and is only an excuse for the irregularity with which everything is done, and for the want of discipline and subordination of the armies. I feel no inclination to join in cooperation with them again, and I do not recommend you have anything to do with them in their present state." End quote. In a private letter from the same period, he was even more scathing, quote, "In the distribution of their forces, they do not consider military operations so much as political intrigue and the attainment of petty political objects." End quote. It seems, at least at this stage, Wellington wanted to simply ignore the Spanish. The British and their Portuguese auxiliaries could carry on the war as they saw fit. From his perspective, the Spanish would only drag them down. Consensus among the British officer corps seems to have been that they would soon face the French in battle. With imperial troops pouring into Iberia, the British would be badly outnumbered and would likely lose. Then there would be another evacuation back to Britain, and Spain and Portugal would finally fall under Napoleonic rule, at least for the foreseeable future. Many in Parliament had their doubts, too. When it came time to debate more expenditures for the campaign in Iberia, many in the opposition rallied against the government. Lord Grenville, a powerful British statesman who had briefly been Prime Minister in 1806 and 7, denounced the motion. Quote, "Portugal is the least defensible country in Europe. It has the longest line of frontier compared with its actual extent of any nation." End quote. Grenville's military credentials were practically non-existent. A lot of officers probably would have objected to this statement, but it made a good line for the newspapers. Grenville concluded his speech by thundering that Parliament had, quote, "a sacred duty to see that not one more life is wasted, not one more drop of blood shed unprofitably." End quote. Despite the fiery rhetoric, the motion passed, but the government was clearly under pressure. Another setback in Iberia might easily sweep the opposition into power. Indeed, this government would soon fall, but that would be due to the failure of the Walcheren campaign in the Netherlands and the failing health of the Prime Minister, Lord Portland. Despite his frustration with the Spanish, Wellington was not as pessimistic as his officers or his masters back in London. He had a plan. Contrary to Lord Grenville's speech, the Portuguese capital of Lisbon is in a highly defensible location, at the end of what is effectively a long peninsula, with the Tagus River estuary on one side and the Atlantic Ocean on the other. The terrain on that peninsula was highly favorable for a military defense, lots of rocky hills punctuated by cliffs and gullies. With the Royal Navy firmly in control of the North Atlantic, a well-prepared defense could use the peninsula as a bottleneck to hold off large enemy forces, much like a mountain pass or river crossing. With enough preparation, the British and Portuguese might be able to hold on to Lisbon almost indefinitely, even if all the rest of Iberia fell under French occupation. Wellington believed that as long as the British and their allies could maintain even a single foothold in Iberia, continued resistance was inevitable. As he himself put it in a letter to the War Ministry, quote, "My opinion is that as long as we remain in a state of activity in Portugal, the contest must continue in Spain." End quote. And so the British and Portuguese began building fortresses near the neck of that peninsula. These fortifications would come to be known as the Lines of Torres Vedras, after a nearby town roughly 50 kilometers or 30 miles north of Lisbon. This would not be a single, continuous system of trenches, like you might have seen in the First World War, but a loose network of forts and prepared defensive positions. If the French launched an offensive towards Lisbon, Wellington planned to conduct an active defense, use these fortifications to force the French to fight on difficult ground of his choosing, rather than simply waiting in fortifications. Setting aside the military dimensions and looking at these fortresses purely as construction projects, the Lines of Torres Vedras were incredibly ambitious. Dozens of sites, stretching over an entire region. The rough terrain and remote locations would make this area easy to defend, but also made it difficult to build. There was a dark side to this plan as well. Colonel George Napier, one of Wellington's own officers, referred to it as, quote, a design of terrible energy, end quote. Not only would the British and Portuguese prepare to resist the French by conventional means, they would try to starve them out. The area north of the lines was to be completely devastated, to ensure any attacking force would be unable to forage for food, as the French were accustomed to doing when on campaign in hostile territory. We've seen in past episodes that when the French attempted operations in Portugal, supply was always a problem. With the terrain sparse, the population hostile, and the British controlling the seas, almost everything had to be brought in by a very tenuous line of communication, stretching all the way across Spain with its poor infrastructure and thousands of guerrillas. Wellington planned to put that tenuous supply line under even more strain, making it impossible for the French to find anything useful anywhere near the lines of Torres Vedras. It was very sound thinking, but the implications were horrific. Tens of thousands of Portuguese peasants would be forcibly removed from their land. Herds of animals like sheep and cattle would be requisitioned and driven south. Orchards and fields of crops and even homes would be put to the torch. Many of the refugees found it impossible to support themselves in the south. Thousands starved. When Colonel Napier expressed his concerns about this element of the project to Wellington, the general countered, quote, "It is better that a part of the country should suffer than that the whole should be lost," end quote. The enterprise of building a new Portuguese army had its dark side as well. By and large, the Portuguese people hated the French, but that didn't necessarily mean they were eager to put on a uniform and go fight in a war. Most of the country's population was poor subsistence farmers. The Portuguese government was weak and inefficient. Before the French invasion, it had little presence in most people's lives. The idea of leaving behind family and livelihood to risk death in defense of the government, which few trusted, did not appeal to the average Portuguese peasant, to put it mildly. What remained of the Portuguese government was quickly forced to resort to conscription to fill out its new regiments. As you might imagine, there was a sense of desperation within the Portuguese military. Many recruiting officers did not hesitate to resort to extreme measures. These so-called new recruits were often, essentially, kidnapping victims. There are reports of Portuguese conscripts being marched into their camps in chains, like prisoners. You might think there would have been a public outcry, or even some kind of anti-British movement among the Portuguese people, but nothing materialized. Wartime censorship may have played a role here, but the simple fact was, almost every Portuguese person with any power or influence understood that their country was fighting for its survival, and so they accepted that difficult sacrifices would have to be made. And of course, it was mostly illiterate peasants making those sacrifices. It was not always pretty, but these desperate measures offered hope when the Allied cause in Iberia seemed almost lost. Using the lines of Torres Vedras to maintain a foothold at Lisbon was a sound strategy. In spite of its recruiting problems, the new Portuguese military was showing promise. But in late 1809, the work had just barely begun. Estimates vary, but after the losses from fever and in combat at Talavera, Wellington had probably under 30,000 British regulars at his disposal. They were augmented by large numbers of Portuguese troops, but their quality varied wildly. Many were poorly trained militia, and as we have seen many times in past episodes, militia units would be of little use in a confrontation with French veterans. There were hundreds of thousands of imperial troops in Iberia. If even a fraction of them marched on Lisbon, the Allies would have been hard-pressed to stop them. But none did. The French leadership did debate going after Wellington. After all, his was the last organized enemy force of any significant size remaining in Iberia. The destruction or evacuation of the British army would practically assure victory in this theater of the war. But instead, they chose to focus on securing control over Spain. With both major Patriot field armies destroyed, the country was practically wide open. There were too many tempting targets within Spain, places that had been out of reach to the French for a year or more, which were now suddenly ripe for the taking. This decision, to fan out across Spain rather than focusing on the British, has been harshly criticized by modern historians. But at this point in the story, the French had to worry about their finances as well as military strategy. 1809 had been a ruinously expensive year for France. Carrying on two separate wars at opposite ends of the continent had taken a huge toll on the treasury as well as the military. As we'll discuss in future episodes, the imperial economy was in a precarious state. Joseph and Napoleon were constantly butting heads over the expenses of the war in Spain. Joseph had all kinds of ambitious plans to modernize the Spanish government and administration, hoping to win over the people with good governance. His older brother believed the country had to be secured first. All revenues should go towards maintaining the French military presence. Once the country was pacified by force, they could begin thinking about winning over hearts and minds. In early 1810, Napoleon wrote to his ambassador in Madrid, telling him to explain to King Joseph, quote, "the impossibility of meeting the enormous expenses of Spain, that I have already sent 300 million francs there, that the dispatch of such considerable sums of money exhausts France, and that the war with Austria has cost me a great deal of money," end quote. A few weeks later, Joseph was informed that the French government would be cutting the subsidies they sent to prop up his regime to a measly 80,000 francs a month. Under these conditions, the French leadership in Spain had to think not only about the best way to defeat the enemy, but also about securing profitable tax bases for Joseph's government. Otherwise, they might not be able to continue paying and feeding their men. And so, Wellington, the British, and the Portuguese were granted a respite. They would have nearly a year to build the lines of Torres Vedras, train their forces, and bring in supplies and reinforcements. While the Allies caught their breath in Portugal, the French rampaged through southern Spain. The Patriots tried desperately to mount a defense, pulling together second-line units and calling out the local militias. However, the French smelled blood. They were moving fast. These forces were crushed or outmaneuvered almost as soon as they could be raised. Imperial forces captured the de facto Patriot capital of Seville on February 1st, 1810. They had been hoping to capture the Supreme Junta itself, but the Spanish leadership had been evacuated days earlier. They fled south to the city of Cadiz, a highly defensible location and a major Atlantic port. Things were looking about as bad as they possibly could for the Spanish cause, but at Cadiz they could at least mount some kind of defense and would be able to receive support from their British allies. At least in theory. As we saw earlier in this episode, Wellington no longer had any faith in the Spanish leadership. By and large, the British military and political establishment shared these views. The Supreme Junta had lost the confidence of the people as well. This period saw mass demonstrations against the junta, some of which saw members of the public actually taking up arms. It was only through skillful negotiations and a bit of luck that large-scale violence was avoided. Even in these dire circumstances, with the country on the precipice of total defeat, people were unwilling to rally behind a government they saw as too incompetent to rule. The Supreme Junta included some very clever politicians. However, when they reconvened in Cadiz, it quickly became clear they had no moves left to make. They had practically no support left among the public. If the Patriot cause had any future, it would almost certainly have to rely on British aid. But the British had made it quite clear they wanted nothing to do with the Spanish government in its current form. The junta had bet everything on its grand offensive on Madrid, and had lost everything. Under the circumstances, the members of the junta had no choice but to vote to permanently dissolve the body and institute a new system of government. The Patriot cause would still be led by a committee, but a much smaller and hopefully more coherent and efficient one. Instead of a 35-member junta, the Spanish Patriots would be led by a 5-member Council of Regency. This was music to the ears of conservatives and reactionaries, many of whom had always felt the Supreme Junta was a little too close to a legislature. To appease liberals, the new government promised to call a meeting of the Cortes, Spain's traditional feudal parliament, roughly equivalent to the French Estates General. It was a bold move, perhaps long overdue. But the new government would be facing a daunting situation. The Regency Council's authority wouldn't extend very far beyond the walls of Cadiz. The councillors formally took office on January 31st. Less than a week later, on February 5th, imperial troops arrived outside the city and began preparing for a siege. In episode 135, I said that in early 1810, Napoleon was optimistic about the war in Iberia. Now that we are more or less caught up with the main narrative, you can probably understand why. When Bonaparte married Marie-Louise of Austria, his troops had surrounded the last Spanish stronghold of any significance and forced the collapse of the Patriot government. In episode 133, we saw many of Spain's American colonies declare independence or launch rebellions against their royal governors. These developments came with very little warning, almost out of the blue. During that episode, I mentioned that bad news from Spain had been the catalyst for those movements. Well, these events we've covered in the last two episodes were that bad news. Just like Napoleon, the Patriots of Spanish America believed that after Ocaña and Alba de Tormes and the fall of Andalusia, the Spanish would soon surrender. They had chosen this moment to act because they did not want to see their countries dealt away to Napoleon at the negotiating table. Setting aside Wellington himself, even the British saw defeat in this theater of the war as practically a foregone conclusion. Looking over Wellington's correspondence with London from this period, the government was primarily concerned with a future evacuation of British forces from Lisbon, not with the progress of the new Portuguese army or the fortifications of the lines of Torres Vedras. Had the French been successful in Iberia, there can be little doubt that it would have gone down in history as the messiest and least impressive of Napoleon's conquests. But in early 1810, there was every indication that the peninsula would indeed be added to the list of places subjugated by the French Empire. Last episode, we quoted from the Spanish poet Juan Bautista Arias's patriotic poem, The Prophecy of the Pyrenees, in which he imagined the Spanish people and their will to resist as a colossus rising from the Pyrenees Mountains. The walls of Cadiz and that metaphorical colossus were all that now stood between Napoleon and victory in Spain. That's all for now. Before we go, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters one last time, and remind you to get in your questions for the next bonus episode in the comment section under the previous bonus episode. As for the rest of you, I hope you'll consider joining us at patreon.com/ageofnapoleon. And, as always, thanks for listening.